This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 13th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, privacy groups push for more information on the use of drones within the U.S.
We want to be able to get the advantages of this technology without having to worry that somebody's looking at us and following us around every time we walk outside of our front door.
Voters in Taiwan head to the polls in presidential elections this weekend, and nuclear power has emerged as one of the central and controversial issues. And we'll look at the deaths of two U.S. soldiers. The military calls them suicides, but families and advocates are raising questions, saying they were the victims of racist hazing. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. U.S. Navy investigators say they have identified the four Marines from a controversial video posted on the internet. The video apparently shows the men urinating on three dead bodies. Investigators told media that the men are part of a sniper division from North Carolina who returned from Afghanistan in September. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton joined the growing chorus condemning the actions of the Marines.
Anyone found to have participated or known about it, having engaged in such conduct, must be held fully accountable.
The Marines involved could be charged with war crimes. Investigators have not released the names of the men. An investigating officer for the Army has recommended a court-martial for Bradley Manning, the soldier accused of releasing hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. A preliminary hearing on his case was held last month. The recommendation will now go higher up the Army chain of command for a final decision. Manning could face life in prison if convicted. President Obama addressed a group of business owners today at the White House, saying he will elevate the Small Business Administration to a cabinet-level position. He also announced an effort to streamline duplicated government services.
So today I'm calling on Congress to reinstate the authority that past presidents have had to streamline and reform the executive branch. This is the same sort of authority that every business owner has to make sure that his or her company keeps pace with the times. And let me be clear, I will only use this authority for reforms that result in more efficiency, better service, and a leaner government.
As an example of the duplications, he said it is excessive that the Department of Homeland Security reports to more than 100 different congressional panels. Executive branch reform power was first granted during the Great Depression, but then revoked during the Reagan presidency. One of Obama's plans is to consolidate six agencies that deal with small businesses.
In this case, six is not better than one. Sometimes more is better. This is not one of those cases, because it produces redundancy and inefficiency. With the authority that I'm requesting today, we could consolidate them all into one department with one website, one phone number, one mission, helping American businesses succeed.
The White House is also launching a new website that brings together business information in one place. The Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act have sparked outrage around the internet because of vague language and the powers the laws give to internet service providers to police content. Now popular online communities are fighting to get their voices heard. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story.
Reddit, an online community and link aggregator that boasts about 2 billion page views a month, will shut down for 12 hours next Wednesday, January 18th. Part of a growing protest, Reddit was urged by its own users to go black and spread awareness about two copyright bills going before Congress, SOPA and PIPA. Opponents say the acts use broad definitions to turn everyday web tools into illegal acts of copyright infringement that could force a website to be shut down or censored. For websites like Reddit, which rely heavily on user-generated content, it could black them out for good. Eric Martin, general manager of Reddit, said the free flow of information that the internet allows would be impossible under the new legislation.
You know, we get billions of page views a day. There's, you know, tens of thousands of people on the site at any given time. It is impossible to sort of filter and police all of that user-generated content for all of these, you know, possible infringements.
The hacktivist group Anonymous has promised to black out their communications in similar fashion. Other websites, such as Google and Facebook, have hinted at taking similar action to spread awareness of the proposed bill. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Canadian officials have come under international scrutiny after a judge yesterday questioned whether the marriage of a U.S. and British citizen wed in Canada is valid. The judge ruled the couple could not seek a divorce in the country because they were never legally married. But now the federal government is responding, saying it intends to clarify the law to make sure the marriages stand. Today, the government of South Sudan announced nearly 60 people were killed in ethnic violence on Wednesday. Health facilities run by Doctors Without Borders have been destroyed in recent attacks, according to the World Health Organization's Tariq Jasarevic. But now thousands of residents are returning to their homes.
As people are slowly returning to Pibok and Lekwungele, there is a likelihood of increased medical needs since most of them have been in a bush for over a week. Most of the patients evacuated in the last 3 days were wounded 5 days ago and have been in hiding for safety reasons.
Violence between two cattle-raising tribes erupted again in late December. It's estimated that as many as 3,000 people have been killed so far and 60,000 residents have been displaced. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. The United States' use of drones in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other nations overseas has drawn much criticism for civilian deaths and a lack of accountability. But even less is known about the drones used within U.S. borders. The digital privacy advocate Electronic Frontier Foundation is trying to change that by suing the Department of Transportation for failing to disclose who is operating the drones domestically and how they are being used. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports from Washington.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation submitted a Freedom of Information Act request in April, arguing that the public deserves to know more about the use of drones within the United States. When the FAA failed to release the information after several months, the digital privacy advocacy group filed a lawsuit that may force them to do so. The group says U.S. citizens need to be more informed as the use of this technology expands. According to the Federal Aviation Administration, the government agency charged with regulating the use of these unmanned aircraft, there are about 50 companies, universities, and government organizations developing and producing about 150 different types of drones in the U.S. alone. Such drones can be as big as a commercial aircraft or as small as a hummingbird, and can gather data using cameras, radar, and heat sensors. Drones are used by the Border Patrol to search for undocumented immigrants, and some local agencies have used them for everything from search and rescue operations to tracking natural disasters. The sheriff in Nelson County, North Dakota, has temporarily borrowed drones patrolling the northern border to nail cattle smugglers, and the Miami-Dade County Police purchased a drone with a federal grant.
We could have used it a couple weeks ago. In fact, we had a guy we were chasing, so in a case like that, it could have been used.
That's Dale Patrick with the Queen Anne's County Sheriff's Department. He says the FAA ran drone tests in the county last year and trained staff on how to use one. When the economy turns around, the department may incorporate the technology into their law enforcement toolbox. Civil liberties groups agree that there are many legitimate reasons to use drone technology, but Jay Stanley, a privacy expert with the ACLU, says there are no laws in place to prevent abuse.
There are times when I think most people would say that it's, you know, an unmanned aircraft could be a really good thing, whether there's a child lost in the wilderness and an aircraft can help search for them or what have you. But, you know, we want to be able to get the advantages of this technology without having to worry that somebody's looking at us and following us around every time we walk outside of our front door.
Stanley says the FAA must regulate when, where, and why drones are used.
Most other industrialized countries have privacy commissioners, and in many countries they have significant powers to enforce the society's privacy norms, and they have overarching privacy laws which put into place, you know, limits on the amount of surveillance that can be done. So it's really a wild west in this country when it comes to privacy.
The use of domestic drones may expand much more rapidly in the years to come as Congress moves towards finalizing a multi-year FAA reauthorization bill. The most recent version of the legislation calls on the FAA to accelerate the approval of drone use, expand the number of test sites, and draft new rules for both military and non-military deployment. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, a drone industry group, spent over $200,000 lobbying Congress in 2011 alone. and several drone conferences scheduled this year to promote the technology are expected to host federal and state agencies. Groups concerned with the unchecked expansion of drone use say an upcoming Supreme Court decision could set a legal precedent for their use and surveillance. In the coming months, the court will rule on whether police departments must get a warrant before using GPS technology to track the movements of a suspect. Stanley says the case raises some big questions about the constitutional right to privacy.
Are we going to update our Constitution and our Fourth Amendment so that it remains relevant in the age of high technology, or is it going to become a dead letter, you know, applicable only to our lifestyles insofar as they match the lifestyles of 18th century founding fathers?
Civil liberties groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU say U.S. laws need to keep up with rapidly changing technology to avoid the dangers of becoming a surveillance state. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The U.S. Army has announced hearings will begin Sunday for eight soldiers charged in the death of Private Danny Chen. The military says the death is a suicide, but has admitted Chen was the victim of racist hazing. The hearings will take place in Afghanistan, though advocates and the soldiers' family want them to take place within the U.S. Today we'll take a look at the case of Danny Chen and another soldier whose family also alleges he was the target of racist hazing before his death last year. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Noor brings us the story from New York.
When the Army informed the parents of Danny Chen that the 19-year-old Army private had died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound in Afghanistan, they reacted with disbelief. Chen had not exhibited signs that he was suicidal and had just asked his family to send him additional supplies. He also had told family members that fellow soldiers targeted him with racist abuse. Chen's parents, Chinese immigrants who don't speak English fluently, turned to their community for help. Activists in New York's Chinese American community enlisted the support of local politicians, held a vigil, marched to the Pentagon, and posted a video on YouTube, all to raise awareness and demand answers about Chen's death.
On October 3rd, my cousin, Private Danny Chen, was found dead in Afghanistan, but he did not die in combat.
A week before Danny died, he was laughing with us on Facebook.
What happened to Danny?
The effort successfully captured the media's attention, and on December 21st, the military announced preliminary charges against eight of Chen's fellow soldiers connected with his death. 1 week later, Army investigators met with Chen's parents and revealed that he had faced extensive racial harassment. Elizabeth Uyang is president of OCA, an Asian American advocacy group working closely with Chen's family.
He was required to do bed crawls over gravel while soldiers threw rocks at him. He was subjected to racial taunting and being called gook, chink, and Dragon Lady.
The harassment campaign culminated on the day of his death, when he reported for guard duty but forgot his helmet.
They made him go back to get it, then they made him do a bread crawl over 100 meters of gravel while soldiers threw rocks at him. And then shortly that morning, a gunshot was heard. And Danny, according to the investigators, was lying on the ground with his rifle next to him.
Uyang says not all of the family's demands have been met, including securing a hearing for the charged soldiers on U.S. soil.
They do not want these soldiers to plea bargain to any lesser offense. Five of the six have been charged with negligent homicide and involuntary manslaughter. Whether homicide or suicide, there's no question that their actions drove Danny to his death.
As supporters and loved ones continue to press for justice, organizer Esther Choi says the Asian American community's advocacy made a difference in speeding up the military's response.
Because I think if we hadn't had that action and we hadn't built up that attention, then it could have just been another passing thing that no one would have paid attention to. So,
Chen's case has given a hope to other families seeking answers about loved ones in the military who died under suspicious circumstances. One case with striking similarities is that of Hampson Daniels McPherson Jr., a 21-year-old U.S. Marine who the military says took his own life by dousing himself with gasoline, then lighting himself on fire while stationed at a base in Okinawa, Japan. McPherson was also a New Yorker and son of immigrant parents. And just like Chen, McPherson's family also alleges that he was subjected to racist hazing by fellow soldiers leading up to his death. His father, Hamson McPherson Sr., said his son's problems began in late 2010 when he responded to racist taunts.
He called and he told me, you know, he says, "Daddy, I'm sorry, but I had a problem." I said, "What happened?" He says, "A white Marine constantly call him cotton picking nigger, and he lose it. He lost his temper. They fought, and this Marine got the worst of it."
McPherson says his son continued complaining of racist treatment over the next 6 months until his death in May. The military has not identified the two individuals who they say witnessed the incident. Officials say that a security camera that would have recorded McPherson's death was not functional at the time. The McPherson family received a visit from the military, which further fueled their doubt over the circumstances surrounding their son's death. The investigator brought along what he said was a suicide note, but McPherson's 18-year-old sister, Danielle, says she questions its authenticity.
I asked, like, can I look at it? And then they gave it to me, and it was, like, on, like, plain, like, printing paper, and it was, like, handwritten, and it was, like, a whole bunch of stuff, like, he would never say, and then it wasn't even his handwriting. Like, I can't read his handwriting.
The family says the military refused to accept a sample of McPherson's writing to help verify the note's authenticity. Unlike Chen's family, the McPhersons have not been able to rally support for his case.
I feel like people have, like, this mental block about the military and, like, the power that they have, and they think, like, they don't want to get involved because something could happen to them, or they're scared to be put out there like that.
The McPherson family says they hope the massive media attention Chen's death has received will help their efforts and pressure the military to fully investigate how Hamson McPherson Jr. died. As both families await details of the deaths of their loved ones, they say they will continue raising awareness until those responsible are brought to justice. They're also calling for the military to institute reforms that will prevent similar race-based hazing in the future. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
Today, the U.S. announced it will begin to restore diplomatic relations with Myanmar, the Southeast Asian country also known as Burma. The move comes after the country's military-led civilian government released more than 600 political prisoners. In a statement released today, President Barack Obama called it, quote, a substantial step forward for democratic reform. Activists welcome the release of prisoners, but they continue to call for further reform. From Bangkok, FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Activists and human rights groups welcomed the Myanmar government's release of more than 650 political prisoners. New York-based Human Rights Watch called the release a crucial step in promoting respect for human rights in Myanmar, also known as Burma. But the organization also called for all remaining political prisoners to be freed immediately. The release covers key members of the 1988 uprising against military rule, including the movement's leaders, Min Kon Young, Nila Tien, and her husband, Kian Min Yu, also known as Ko Jimmy, and Te Kwai, Buddhist monk Ushan Gambira, who played a leading role in 2007 protest led by monks, was also released, as well as Shan ethnic leader Kun Tun U. Several reporters working for independent news organizations were also freed. Aung Soar, editor of news magazine The Irrawaddy, says the release was a bold step by President Thein Sein after overcoming resistance within the government.
The president had made a decision several months ago that all will be released. So I think we are hoping that by the end of this year, and all political prisoners should be out of the prison.
Aung Soar, who also fled the 1988 military crackdown, says that after almost three decades of political struggle, Myanmar was heading in the right direction. But Aung Soar says the government has more work to do.
I think the thing is how government going to reach out to the ethnic minorities. And, I think that national reconciliation is the next step, how to achieve the genuine national reconciliation with all groups, including ethnic minorities and groups, resistant groups, and so that that we could see more stable Burma and then Western government will be convinced to remove and lift the sanctions.
The United States, Europe and Australia have imposed economic, financial and trade sanctions on Myanmar in a bid to press the government toward political reform. After years of little progress, the appointment of President Thein Sein last March following 2010's general elections has marked a new start for Myanmar. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house detention and is now preparing to stand for a seat in parliamentary elections in April. Debbie Stoddard, spokeswoman for the rights group The Alternative ASEAN Network, says the release of the prisoners highlights the success of sanctions against the military establishment to force change.
This is clear evidence that economic sanctions on Burma have worked. The sanctions functioned as a very important bargaining chip to push the authorities to do as they promised that they would. They needed to deliver on their promises. It's very clear from the past few months that the authorities have embarked on a very significant campaign to remove sanctions. And this is part of the campaign.
The release of prisoners included lifting the house arrest of former Prime Minister and Military Intelligence Chief Khin Yunt. The total number of political prisoners behind bars is unclear. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Burma, based in Thailand, has put the total at more than 1,000 political detainees still behind bars. Officials and other rights groups say the total figure is lower. Bo Ji, Secretary General of the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, called the steps very encouraging, but said many of those released had signed documents warning they could be rearrested later. But Bo Ji was cautiously optimistic.
Anyway, there is like good news for political prisoners, even though they were not recognized as political prisoners by the government.
But Bo Ji says more needs to be done by the government to promote political reform before the international community lifts the economic sanctions.
One of their intentions is to lift sanctions by the United States and European Union. But I think it is not enough just only release of like, political prisoners. They need to improve for the rule of law and other. They need to improve for the human rights violation in Burma. The human rights violation is getting worse and worse, especially in the ethnic areas.
Myanmar is now coming under increasing international diplomatic attention. Several foreign ministers, including U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have added their support to the program of political reform. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
Voters in Taiwan head to the polls this weekend to elect a president, and amid the issues of jobs and the economy, evolving relations with mainland China, and regional stability, nuclear power has emerged as a central and controversial issue for all three of the candidates in Saturday's vote. For more, we're joined by Pei Tae Lien. She's a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of California at Santa Barbara and a native of Taiwan. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
All three of the primary candidates have addressed nuclear power one time or another. One of them, Democratic Progressive Party Chairwoman Tsai Ing-wen, proposed a plan called the 2025 Nuclear Free Home Plan. That's in which three of the working plants now would be retired in 2025 when they're scheduled to end. How do you see a proposal like that in the context of this election?
I think it is almost an inevitable trend that somebody will propose this, and that will be an ideal state that when Taiwan will be nuclear power free, that Taiwan would be able to find a solution to its power need by using perhaps increasingly more reliance on a safer alternative power, such as, solar power. But I believe it should be a welcoming position. But of course, I know the concern of the opposition, the current sitting party, is that Taiwan has this need and imminent need that need to be addressed, and that Taiwan is a basically resource pool island, and that nuclear power has been the cheapest way and the most efficient way for the government for the island to try to power its industry.
Well, Taiwan does depend on nuclear power for at least some of its needs. Two of the power plants that are operating now, they're located in the northernmost region of Taiwan, and they use a General Electric design for their boiling water reactors that are similar to the ones that were operating at Fukushima. And they have come under criticism from grassroots groups from within Taiwan because of that. How much did Fukushima and the crisis in Japan change this issue for the elections in Taiwan?
Well, I know certainly because of the nuclear disaster in Japan, Taiwan's people has been made more aware of the risk they are facing. However, I believe in Taiwan's politics, the main issue is actually not on nuclear issues, but on the relationship between the mainland and Taiwan, so the independence issue. My perspective as somebody who used to be there, when in a time when people were struggling to make ends meet, when Taiwan was still developing rather than developed, at that time, environmental issue and the nuclear issue is not an issue. It was just out of necessity that government, also authoritarian government at that time, we were just convinced that there's no other option. But I know things have changed profoundly, and people now are middle class, mostly middle class, and they have been increasingly conscious about the environment, not only just its local, its island, but also global. Actually, Taiwan is part of the global system, so we also felt responsible for the global security and global environmental quality rather than just the people in Taiwan themselves.
You mentioned issues of security, environmental issues. There's also a fourth plant that's in the process of being built in New Taipei City. That's on the northeastern coast of Taiwan. It has been opposed by local residents, by environmentalists. They have called for a referendum on the project. How has this production of a new plant entered into the dialogue?
It has become an issue. It has become a more central issue than the ruling party would like it to be, and I think that's a good thing because, indeed, as I said before, that the nuclear security in Taiwan is not just a Taiwan's issue. Well, of course, we all know that. It's a good thing for the opposition party to try to raise this issue to the awareness of the people in Taiwan. And then this forces the ruling party to try to address the issue, even though in the previous years they seem to try to underplay the issue or just to the neglect of the concerns of local people. And therefore, we know that there are serious and continuous issues of protest and expressions of concern from the parties that you mentioned in the beginning of the broadcast.
Pei Te Lien is a professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She joined us to talk about the upcoming presidential elections in Taiwan this weekend. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.